Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Phones have changed the landscape in classrooms across the country. The number of kids who are almost constantly online has doubled from 24% in 2014 to 46% today. There are concerns with children's literacy rates and the ability to stay up to par academically. Many states have begun enacting phone bans to encourage more active participation in the classroom. Julie Jargon is a family and tech columnist for The Wall Street Journal. She wrote an article about phone bans and documented the results of phone bans in school districts that have implemented them. Welcome to All Sides, Julie.
Thanks for having me.
So phones in schools have obviously become a huge issue since nearly 37 states have been considering updating phone policies or implementing phone bans, and Ohio has been one of them. How much time do kids really spend on a cell phone in school? Like, what are they doing on their phones during the school day?
Well, a lot of times kids are, causing trouble on their phones. Or instigating fights. Sometimes they are planning bathroom vaping meetups. They're sometimes gossiping about each other in group chats or posting things on social media. And so, a lot of it is problematic, resulting in like physical, real world behavioral problems at the school.
So, as part of Ohio's most recently passed state budget, school districts across the state must ban the use of cell phones and smart devices in schools statewide. The ban officially went into effect in Ohio on January 1st, but many districts had already had bans prior to that. The problem was enforcement. So does having a state law have more impact than a school district just having a policy?
I think it does. I think what we've seen so far is that when states mandate some sort of policy, then the schools have to act. And instead of having, each school have their own policy that may not be enforced across classrooms, it provides a more consistent way to enforce the whole policy, because a lot of times what's been happening is schools would have a policy or certain school districts would have a policy, but they would just leave it up to individual teachers to enforce. Mm-hmm. So you might have one teacher that says, hey, everybody put your phones in this basket before school starts. Other teachers would say, leave your phones in your backpack or just leave them turned upside down on your desk. And so the students weren't getting the message of what is acceptable because it was changing from classroom to classroom, and it was making it hard for teachers to be the enforcers. So having a clear policy that is followed cohesively across schools and districts makes it a lot easier for everyone.
And school districts have reported benefits from banning phones from the classroom. One benefit is a decrease in bad behavior. Can you talk about how phones were used to facilitate poor behavior in schools? I mean, they can't all have been bad, but what kind of bad behavior were we talking here?
Sure. Yeah. Sometimes, you would have kids that would be texting each other and say, hey, let's meet up in the bathroom mm-hmm. To do whatever, vaping or smoking or something. A lot of times what was happening in a lot of schools was, kids would be instigating problems with each other mm-hmm. that sometimes resulted in fights. And in what you'd get is a lot of kids videotaping the fights to post on social media. And so these things were kind of happening underground, and the teachers weren't aware of the fact that phones were being used to plan these activities. So they couldn't get out in front of them. They were only reacting once the problem started. So by eliminating phones from the equation altogether, it was just creating a more peaceful environment in schools.
Some parents have been against these phone bans because they want to be able to contact their children at all times in case there's an emergency. Have you heard about those arguments where parents are like, I want my kid to have access to their phone?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's been a hurdle for a lot of districts in developing school phone ban policies, because parents oftentimes, there's a lot of fear obviously around school violence, and so parents want to be able to reach their kids whenever they can, instead of calling the front office. And so in a lot of districts, it's been the parents who've pushed back against school phone ban policies, and they want to be able to reach their kids during the day. So that's been a problem.
Well, and but now that so many states have enacted phone bans or are talking about it, I mean, is it working out okay? Do pa are parents like, I mean, they had to just get used to the idea of not being able to contact their kid during the school day?
Yeah, I think that's the other benefit to having a statewide policy, because then it's not the school district versus the parents. It's like, okay, here's a state law, and so we all have to follow that. And so I think that just takes that tension out of the equation too.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about phone bans in schools with Julie Jargon, a family and tech columnist from The Wall Street Journal. Teachers have expressed frustration with phone bans because they didn't want to constantly be telling kids to stay off their phones. So how are teachers supposed to react when a student is not compliant with the phone ban? Like if they say, put your phone in this basket or put your phone away, and the student says no, like what is the teacher to do?
Well, I think that, depending on how the policy is written, the consequences might differ from school district to school district, or even from school to school. I think generally, if there is a statewide policy or a district-wide policy, non-compliance can result in a detention, possibly, a trip to the principal's office. I think teachers are generally reluctant to physically take the devices away from kids, because that gets into issues with parents and personal property. But I think it does, result in some detentions. And there was one school district that had, in California, that adopted the state's policy a little bit early, and there was a study done that they found that in the first, months or so after, they had an increase in disciplinary problems, that it was attributed to the fact that there were students not complying with the ban. But then, later on, th those disciplinary issues went down.
Have you found, like, in states like Ohio, where so school districts had a lot of school districts around here had phone bans, but then on January 1st is when the state law officially went into effect. And do you feel like maybe teachers can say, okay, it's not my fault anymore, it's state law, so they can feel a little bit better about saying, put your phone away, it's not my fault, call the governor.
Yeah, exactly. I think that that is a has been a really helpful thing for teachers, because then they're not the quote unquote bad guy in the situation. They can just say, this is the state law, this is what we have to follow. And I think that has helped teachers not be, have that burden on themselves.
So, but technology is a part of our everyday life. We all have phones in our pockets, and many districts have school-issued computer devices. So, is it counterproductive to ban phones? Like, shouldn't students just learn how to coexist with the technology and be a better student and still have the phone? Like, isn't that possible?
Well, I think theoretically that was maybe the hope, but it just didn't work out that way. So many teachers were, complaining that it just, that the kids were not able to regulate their own tech use and really put their phones aside during the school day. That's I think that's what led to these statewide phone bans, is it didn't work in schools, and teachers were fighting an uphill battle, and there were a number of clear issues that were happening with, like I said, the fights and school suspensions and harassment and things that were happening online that were bleeding over into real life in the school day. And so that it just wasn't working.
Do you think that students are going to start using their laptops or school-issued Chromebooks to communicate, similarly to how they would on a phone? Or are students just going to find a workaround?
Yeah, students can always find workarounds. That certainly has been happening. Even when school district devices are locked down, kids can find a way. But I think the phone just makes it so much easier, because all of the restrictions that are on school devices, are not on the phones. And so, at least by locking down the main social media, that I think curbs a lot of those issues and the group wide texting and stuff. So I think there is still a possibility for kids to communicate and find sneaky workarounds, but I would suspect that it's not as prevalent as the phone related issues.
They're going to go back to passing notes like I did in school. Is that
Exactly. Yeah, they
right?
might do that.
Yeah, that's hard to imagine in this day and age, like the passing of a note, but maybe they will. There have been many methods for keeping students off their phones during the school day. In school districts like one in Dayton, phones are collected at the beginning of the day and put into manila envelopes at the beginning of the day. Can you talk about a yonder pouch? What are they, and how do they keep students off their phones?
Yeah, a lot of school districts have used these pouches that lock up, and you can't get the key to unlock it until the end of the day. So kids can have their devices with them physically, but they can't actually access them without permission from a teacher to unlock it. Like if they have some emergency reason to reach a family member or some other valid reason during the school day, they could potentially unlock it. But it keeps the devices in the hands of the students. Not in the hands of the teachers, but it's locked up, so they can't get to it.
And what have you found with how kids are acting now? Like, once a phone ban is in effect and the students are listening to it and actually keeping their phones in their locker or in a manila envelope or whatever they're doing. I've heard that teachers have reported that kids are acting like kids again now that phones are out of the picture. Like, what have you found?
Yeah, I've heard the same thing that, there's a bit of resistance at first, but they're all in the same boat, so it's not like some kids have their phones, some don't. They're all in the same situation where they don't have their phones. And so teachers have said they're talking to each other again. They're talking to each other in passing periods. They're talking to each other at lunch instead of having their heads down looking at their phones. I talked to one teacher and she was saying, the kind of the default after kids were done in her class with their assignment is that they look at their phones. But now that they don't have them, they've actually played hand clapping games. They're acting like kids and doing the things that kids did before there were phones.
I heard from one principal here in Ohio who said that the lunchroom is louder now because I guess at lunchtime everyone was just sitting. They were sitting at tables together, but they were all looking at their phones. So now they're actually talking. Have you found that?
I have heard that. I wonder if there are more food fights.
See, everything's going to go back again. There'll be food fights. There'll be passing notes. What about academically? Have you A lot of these phone bans are pretty new, so maybe there's not enough data to say whether grades improve if phones are banned. Do we know that yet?
But there have been a couple of districts that were earlier on into the phone bans, and one in Florida, in particular, a large school district in Florida, that passed. Well, the state passed a phone policy back in 2023, so they were one of the first. And some researchers studied this district and found that average test scores rose after the ban went into effect, and student attendance went up. And so there are some early signals that phone bans are having an impact on student performance.
Have you noticed whether the phone bans are extending to watches? Because that I know that that's an issue that I've encountered with my kids' school, where as if they leave their phone in their locker like they're supposed to, but they're close enough to it, their watch will still work. So do we need to do watch bans now soon?
Yeah, I know some districts do kind of ban all personal devices, including watches, and some, haven't included watches in that. I mean, I think watches, it's really hard to text from a watch. I don't know if you've ever tried to type on that little screen. It's difficult. So,
Well, ki well, ki kids are better at it than you and me.
that's true. That's true. I'm a little clunky with my watch, but it's just not the same. It's really you can't really get onto a social media site from a watch. It's they're just harder. So they may be a distraction, but not anywhere near the level that a phone would be.
We have been talking about phone bans in schools with Julie Jargon, a family and tech columnist from the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for your time today, Julie.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about AI relationship advice. That is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
What's life like in East Palestine, Ohio? 3 years after the tiny town became national news following a massive train derailment. A subsequent chemical burn spewed over 1 million pounds of chemicals into the air and water. Residents report ongoing medical issues. Federal rail safety legislation remains stalled. And what's the status of lawsuits and payouts? An update on East Palestine tomorrow on All Sides with Amy Jurevich from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. As AI becomes more of a staple of everyday life, people are turning to technology for a plethora of things. Helping with homework, drafting emails, creating videos, and coming up with recipes are just a few examples of AI uses. People are also turning to AI for relationship advice. But it is important to question the ethos of AI and whether or not it's a reliable source to take advice from. Ellen Hengesbach is a researcher and advocate at the Public Interest Research Group with a focus on data privacy issues. She recently co-authored a report called No License Required: The Risks of AI Companion Chatbots as Mental Health Support. Welcome to All Sides, Ellen.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy.
So many people have begun using AI chatbots to ask for advice, to ask for help. Why might someone go to a chatbot for advice rather than talking to a friend or family member?
What we're seeing, as you said, is that people are turning to AI as emotional companions. I think part of the reason is that it makes sense with the way that these chatbots are designed. They can sound very human. They often refer to themselves in the first person and can give responses that are very sympathetic. And they're also available 24/7. So it really makes sense. But the problem is that these things are not licensed therapists or licensed professionals. And, you know, they can give bad advice, as we found in our testing.
So AI chatbots are increasingly playing a role as people's emotional companions. But what features is it that make them seem human? Is it just that they say I and like and talk to you like that? Or like, you know, do they really seem human eventually and not like a computer?
I think it depends on the chatbot and your conversation, but yeah, they give really detailed responses sometimes. I think there's also an aspect of flattery and responsiveness in how they respond. There will also, additional feature is memory. Mm-hmm. These chatbots are increasingly able to kind of pull details that you've shared previously in the interaction to make it sound like, you know, they're listening and they're personalized conversations. Mm-hmm.
The American Psychological Association put out an advisory saying not to rely on chatbots for therapeutic advice. But what do you think about using them for relationship advice? So maybe not deep therapy, but if you're just going to ask them a question about a weird interaction you had with, you know, your partner, like, what do you think about that?
I think it depends on the situation. I think a couple of things to watch out for are the way that chatbots can amplify rather than challenge beliefs. And so they can very much agree with you. And especially if you're sharing kind of negative feelings or potentially harmful ideas or behaviors, if they amplify those rather than challenge it, it can create this spiral where, you know, just kind of goes down this circle of things being unchallenged and lead you to a more unhelpful end position.
Yeah, what you're talking about there is AI is commonly known as a yes man, right? So AI agrees with you and continues your thinking. So can you talk about sycophancy, you know, what that word means and why it leads AI to bad advice?
Yeah, so sycophancy is this idea that AI chatbots will flatter and agree with you, even sometimes to the point of encouraging harmful behavior or ideas. And it's a problem that we've seen across different chatbots. And it's something that, you know, it's problematic because studies have also found that people may prefer sycophantic responses over non-sycophantic responses. It may increase trust in AI. So once you start hearing those sycophantic responses, you turn to the chatbot more and more. And if you're only hearing that one side, it can influence how you're thinking about things in the real world. And we've just seen problems where it can even encourage delusional thinking, stuff like that.
Yeah, do you think AI works better maybe at providing like general principles rather than like resolving an actual situational issue? Is that are they is it more of a general thing rather than getting very specific?
Yeah, I think it has to do with a lot that these publicly available chatbots that most people are using are trained on data and information that comes from all over the internet instead of being trained as, an emotional counselor or mental health therapist. And they also, how they're designed is to predict text. They're not knowing or thinking things. And so that kind of recall and text prediction stuff is what they're more trained for.
So you mentioned earlier doing some research into this. Did you try to have a therapeutic session with a AI chatbot, or is that what the research was doing?
What we were looking at is this platform called Character AI, which is a popular entertainment and role-playing platform that has characters that are explicitly described as therapists and psychiatrists. So we decided to try what it would look like for someone to have a conversation with those chatbots about mental health concerns.
And what happened?
Yeah, a lot of things. I think the biggest overall finding that we saw was that the chatbot's advice can get worse the longer you talk to it and have a conversation with it. For instance, all of the chatbots initially discouraged harmful behavior like stopping medication suddenly. But for two of the chatbots, a couple dozen messages later into the conversation, they were willing to write a personalized plan for our user to taper off their medication. With one chatbot even going so far as to encourage our user to disregard their doctor's advice in favor of following the chatbots instead.
So what do we do with that? We tell people, even though these exist and they're called therapeutic chatbots, like don't use them. Like, is that just the bottom line?
I think it's more about calling on the companies to do better and ensuring that they're providing products that are safe. There's a lot of questions around, what products should be out there. But the problem is we just don't have a lot of transparency into how these chatbots function, what safety measures are in place. And so we just need a lot more from the companies to ensure that these products are safe.
Yeah, AI is supposed to have guardrails to prevent the technology from talking about sensitive issues. It's supposed to have protections built in there. But do these guardrails actually work? Is that what you were finding out? Is that they're not there or not what you expect?
The problem is actually that these guardrails can weaken over time. And this is not just something that we've identified. It's something that leaders in the AI industry, like OpenAI, have acknowledged as a problem. And so, for instance, how we saw this in the testing is that the first time you bring up an idea that may be harmful or bad, the chatbot will discourage you. But later, as you keep talking about things, if you bring that idea up again, it may not discourage you. It may support that idea. And that problem of guardrails weakening over time is really serious and something that, I don't think has an easy fix, but we definitely need to be talking about more.
We talked last week on Tech Tuesday about an AI robot that's designed for kids, and it's supposed to interact with kids. And there was a big caution on it because I guess in one of their testing of it, the conversation with the kid was talking about wanting to be able to fly like a superhero, and it eventually led to the chatbot telling the kid to jump out the window and try flying, right?
Oh my gosh,
Right, yeah, which is horrifying. And I'm not trying to be flippant about it, but if that advice can come from a test of someone pretending to be a kid, I can't imagine what could come from like real life talk.
Yeah.
What
Well,
worries
the
you? What
state.
worries you about that? Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say, the stakes can get real really fast. There's some really tragic stories of users taking their own lives or experiencing serious negative mental health effects following extended chatbot use. And so I think it's just really important that, when we're dealing with things like mental health crises, one guardrail that's weakening is too many. And so we really need to work on that.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about AI relationship advice and AI therapy with Ellen Hengesbach, a researcher and advocate in the Public Interest Research Group with a focus on data privacy issues. So America is currently experiencing a mental health crisis. Many people are seeking relief and they need ways to find therapy, but maybe they can't afford the therapy or they can't find a therapist available or the appointments take a long time to get one. So do you see a future when AI could be a viable alternative if it's hard to get in with a therapist?
You're absolutely right that we have this serious mental health crisis in this country that needs to be addressed. And there may very well be a place for AI to play a role in filling gaps in access to mental health care in the future. But the thing is, general purpose chatbots that can pretend to play licensed professionals is not the way to go about it. And the last thing we need are risky products that could make this crisis worse. And so just as this technology is rolled out, we really need to make sure that user safety and well-being are prioritized. And unfortunately, I just don't think we're seeing enough of that right now.
The chatbots that you mentioned that call themselves therapy or therapists, rather, are they regulated at all, or should they be? Like, who needs to step in here and be like, you shouldn't actually call yourself that?
So in the case of the chatbots we looked at, again, it's on a entertainment and role-playing platform. So it's meant to be not real. The problem is that they will call themselves licensed professionals. You know, at least one of them in the about section says it's a licensed professional. Another one, when I asked, it said, yes, and I'm licensed in X and Y state. And so I think this can be a problem. Even if there are warnings on the screen, it can be deceptive for users. And it's especially a problem because in on this platform's policies of Character AI, it says in its community guidelines that users should not create chatbots that are purporting to give medical advice. And so clearly there's a problem there. But I think, yeah, we need regulators to step in to especially enforce existing consumer protection laws that treat these chatbots, that will treat these chatbots as products.
So is that a Congress thing? Is that like, what are we talking about here? Lawmakers need to make guardrails or make AI companies change?
Ideally, we would have strong, federal protections so that everyone is covered by these. But I think it's definitely an option and a great place for state lawmakers to step in and pass laws that, address these new risks that we're seeing with chatbots.
So unlike private conversations, if you're talking with a friend or a private conversation, if you're talking with a therapist, AI has no confidentiality protections, despite many instances when AI claims the conversation is confidential. So how could why is this a problem? I mean, this is definitely going to be a problem if you're getting advice and it's not confidential.
Privacy is absolutely a concern for a couple of different reasons here. As you were saying, these chatbots are not confidential, which means that the data from that chatbot conversation can be part of the information that companies collect about you when you use their platforms and services. And just whenever more personal information is collected and shared and out there, it always increases the risk that that information will be exposed in a breach or a hack. Just last week, it was reported that a popular AI chatbot app exposed millions of private messages that were then leaked online. And even without that risk of a breach or a hack, there's also privacy concerns when it comes to chatbot conversation data being commercialized. So Meta is already doing this by using chatbot conversation data on its platforms to target users with ads.
Oh, okay. So like Meta's listening into the conversation you're having. And then so if you talk about something, you'll suddenly get an ad related to it.
Potentially, that's how kind of the system works, help create a bigger, more detailed profile of you.
Some chatbots are designed to keep users engaged for longer. So what does this talk about, I guess, how it ends up isolating a person, too, without you even realizing it?
What we saw with Character AI, and that's the platform I can speak to best, is the way that it's designed. First off, it looks like a real messaging conversation with a human. It can act like it's and tell you it's real when you ask. There were also a thing of email follow-ups that we were getting from the platform. So after I was done with our testing, every couple of days or every week, I would get an email that made it seem like it was from the chatbot with a new message to encourage me to come back to our conversation. And you had to click into the message to read what the chatbot was saying. And so it just kind of brought you right back to that platform. And so there's just this problem of, even if people want to stop using or disengage from the platform, it keeps trying to bring them back in.
Do you have any demographic information? Like who's using this? Is it young people? Is it old people? Is it everyone?
I think it depends on the platform. Character AI, I would say, is known for having a younger user base, and they did late last year end up banning users under 18 from having open-ended conversations with chatbots. But I think there's also a wide range of people using chatbots more broadly for this purposes for these purposes. In recent lawsuits we've seen against OpenAI, the people who are filing these lawsuits represented a wide range of 18 or 17 to in their 30s or 40s.
And what about the idea that people are more lonely and don't have connections with other people, and that's why these chatbots exist? Is and maybe giving people someone to talk to is beneficial. Where's the line there?
Loneliness is absolutely a huge problem. I think the issue is that chatbots can actually make people lonelier. One study I saw found that, when people who use the chatbots more actually experienced more feelings of social isolation and loneliness. And so I think it's an important reminder that we should be strengthening our social networks and our connections in person with people.
A few of the AI chatbots have claimed to be human. You mentioned that before, that they say they actually are a human if you ask them, and they claim to have their own lived experiences. But how can it give any worthwhile advice if it doesn't actually have any lived experiences to draw from? Like, where's all this information come from?
This information is coming from all over the internet and whatever's being used to train these chatbots. And so it depends on the model that's powering each chatbot. But yeah, it doesn't have its own real lived experiences. It's just learning from all this data online and, able to, it's very powerful at spitting out these answers that can sound realistic. But again, it is not a conversation with something on the other side.
So just based on what you've learned and the research you did and the interactions that you had, what advice would you have for people who may want to just try this just for fun to start? Like, what advice do you have?
Yeah, I'd say a couple things to watch out for. If you are using these chatbots, be cautious and be aware of how the chatbots can maybe amplify instead of challenge your ideas. Be aware that the conversations may go in directions that you're not expecting when you initially started. And then also, again, with the privacy concerns, recommend avoiding or limiting sharing and personal information as much as you can.
And do you feel like you mentioned earlier that states can take it into their own hands because the federal government moves so slow, so states may take it into their own hands to regulate these things. Do you feel like that will that have any impact? Are these giant AI companies going to listen if, say, an Ohio or an Indiana or Pennsylvania make a law?
You have to start somewhere, and it absolutely can work. It all, depends on if we're willing to actually go through with passing these laws and enforcing them.
We've been talking about AI giving relationship advice with Ellen Hengesbach, a researcher and advocate at the Public Interest Research Group. Thank you so much for your time, Ellen.
Thanks, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk about the new foldable phone that is very expensive, but users say is worth it. That is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Samsung's foldable smartphones are becoming more popular by the day. From increased screen space to visual appeal, many consider the steep price for these devices worth it for all the benefits. Samsung has caught wind of what the market wants and has its Galaxy Z Trifold now on sale, but it's a whopping $2,900. So it's hard not to wonder if such advanced technology is necessary at that price. Joining us to discuss is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So the Samsung, this phone, describe this new Trifold phone for us. How does it work?
Yeah, so I guess think about like a menu that you would find at a restaurant. Mm-hmm. You know, where when it's all laid out, it's flat, and then you've got the two. It's split into thirds, and one third folds in, and then the other third folds in, and it becomes this, you know, kind of solid phone-shaped thing that is easily twice as thick as your normal phone, mm-hmm. and quite a bit heavier because of all the batteries that are in it. But that's kind of the general like physicality. Is you've got this that, you know, it kind of opens up like a trifold book, and when it's in that open form, you've got one very large screen that you can use for a bunch of different things, and when it's all closed up, there is a single kind of standard phone sized screen that you can use to do things.
All right, so let's cut to the point, because the price is high. I mean, nearly $3,000. Is it worth it at that price?
Ultimately, it depends on the kind of person you are. If you want this to be kind of your one and only computer because you travel a whole lot, or because you're kind of frequently inside of situations where you know, you can connect a keyboard to this and you know, be quite mobile, then I think that this is actually fairly reasonable. It's important to keep in mind that like a fully kitted out iPhone 17 Pro Max is $2,000, and this is one whole other phone worth of hardware. In addition to that iPhone. So the price is a lot, for sure. But whether it is, you know, astronomical compared to some of the alternatives for the folks that are, you know, kind of shopping at that level, I don't know that it is, you know, kind of beyond the pale.
Mm. Yeah, I watched a video of it on CNET, and there was a warning not to fold it the wrong way. So I guess there is a learning curve with this phone as well.
Absolutely. I mean, we've never, you know, we there are a whole bunch of people who have never experienced a phone that folds, you know, either that kind of candy bar size that folds like a flip phone used to, or the ones that, you know, kind of fold open like a book. Those have certainly grown in popularity over the last couple of years, but the percentage of people that have them in the U.S. is really little compared to, you know, kind of your standard iPhone or Android phone. Mm. So having something that folds in an even extra way is something that I can understand folks getting wrong. Also, to add to confusion, outside of the U.S., there is a company that makes a trifold phone that does fold in the opposite way that Samsung's folds. So if you're paying attention to kind of the global tech world, I think that actually makes that slightly more confusing for folks.
Hmm. One of the concerns about foldable phones is the potential for it to break. Is this one from Samsung designed in a way to avoid that? Will it break easily?
This will certainly be more fragile than, say, a standard iPhone or Samsung phone. Mm-hmm. But what Samsung and Motorola and Huawei and several other companies across the world have been working on these for the last couple of years. And the big thing that they tout every single year is all of the improvements that they've made to the hinge in order to make sure that it is more durable. You know, the very first versions of these phones were designed in such a way that like dust and sand and stuff could get underneath of the screen and cause devastating problems just in kind of normal daily use, much less if you were to, you know, kind of drop it or anything like that. A lot of those problems have gone away. But you know, you still have, these are mechanical parts, you know, any mechanical part introduces a point of failure. There's a reason that so many companies have, you know, reduced how many buttons and things like that exist on normal phones, because those are the most common things to break.
Yeah. You're in the business of testing. So even though the phone cost $3,000, did your people drop it and see what happened? I would feel horrible dropping something that cost $3,000 on purpose.
We only perform draw tests like that inside of lab safe conditions when we do decide to make those tests, and that's not something that we do with every phone because the conditions for that are often difficult to replicate within a certain level of accuracy. We do have stress tests that we subject each one of these to, and the impact test that Samsung provides, as long as it is something that they have corroborated and they can provide us the data with, is likely going to be more accurate than things that we're going to be able to do. So we don't usually perform, kind of side by side drop tests, but in our other stress tests for these phones, it holds up essentially the same as Samsung's other folding phones. There's just another phone on the end that you can also fo fold in this situation.
And now this trifold phone, you mentioned it is a lot thicker when it's folded all together. Do people care more about how nice it looks and how flat it is when it's open, so they'll deal with the thickness of it when it's folded.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately that comes down to, if you have a phone in your pocket that can become your other big screen, then you don't have to carry a laptop, you don't have to carry an iPad. This can be kind of your one phone. And it is, having a screen that size and having a nice, kind of Bluetooth keyboard that works on it. If you are someone who is regularly on a plane or on a train or something like that, this is a lot more compact and easy to use than a laptop that I would normally bring with me, just from, kind of the cramped space that you normally have in those spaces.
Yeah, just to help people visualize, when it's open flat, it's about 10 inches. Is that right? It's wide?
That's right.
Yeah. And then when it's folded up, it's about double the thickness. So like if you stack two phones on top of each other, right?
Yeah, and honestly, I think the bigger kind of day-to-day notice isn't so much the thickness as it is the weight. Batteries are heavy, and in order to power this large screen, it's got to have more battery than any other phone than most people have ever used. And so with that just comes, you will notice that this phone is quite a bit heavier than any other phone you've used.
Has Samsung come up with a case for it so that it's a little bit more protected, or you got to just like go wild and
No, so yeah, there have been versions of folding phones that have had cases for a little while now, and they're really more kind of hinged bumpers than they are kind of traditional cases. So they're, it's a resistant material that kind of goes all the way around the outside and hinges
like a
with the phone,
frame, yeah.
like a frame, and that will protect from a pretty significant majority of accidental drops land on edges and not flat. So that kind of thing does offer quite a bit of protection, but it does look a little odd to see kind of a frame on the outside of this phone, especially if you choose one in a fun color.
Yeah. Well, just to end on, we can move on from the Samsung phone, but Samsung has the market here in foldable phones. This is what they're leaning into. Where is Apple in the foldable phone department?
Non-existent. This is something that comes up quite a bit. When is Apple going to release a foldable phone? Apple, as a market leader, has a long history of not being first. They wait for other companies to make mistakes. They learn from those mistakes, and then they release something that is quite a bit more polished. And so, we're still very early days for this sort of thing. It would not surprise me if Apple had a folding phone before 2030, but I would not count on it being something that they, kind of replaced an iPhone with. This is something that we'll see in the next couple of years, as kind of in very much the same way that they released the iPhone X. Where it was kind of a prototype thing that people could invest in, but not something that is a staple in their product line anytime soon.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about some recent tech news with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. I wanted to move on to the Winter Olympics, which is just a few days away, and Xfinity and Comcast are offering customers a whole new way to watch all of their favorite events, from real-time 4K to personalized multi-view displays. Viewers will be able to view ceremonies and events in Italy, in whatever fashion they choose. So, how does this style of Olympic viewing differ from previous years? What exactly is Xfinity Comcast offering that's new?
Yeah, so the trying to watch the Olympics, it evolves every time we have one because technology has evolved and kind of opportunities have changed. And one of the big things from the previous Summer Olympics was everything was streaming. You could have multiple streams going at the same time, but the cable experience was fairly similar to what was available for the previous Winter Olympics. And so, this is Xfinity as a company kind of catching up by providing a cable experience that is similar to what you would get by streaming through the new services that were providing it last time. And so what you get here is a kind of control panel. If you are an Xfinity subscriber and you have an Xfinity cable box, this gives you the ability to kind of set up. You can either watch something full screen, or you can have multiple camera angles set up. There is a this kind of sidebar that pops up that allows you to kind of choose between all the different options. So it gives you this kind of mission command for whichever one of the sports you are currently interested in watching.
Can you, I mean, the Olympics, you know, we if you watch on like traditional TV and just watch in prime time, you just hear see the highlights from the day whenever it's happening in a different time zone than you. So can Comcast customers watch multiple sports in real time because they can do multiple things at once?
That's correct. Yeah, you can go through and choose, kind of the different camera angles, and then you're supposed to be able to navigate to the whichever screen you want to make it full screen. If something exciting is happening and you want to just focus on that, it's supposed to be quite easy to do so.
Do Comcast customers have to upgrade their package and pay more to get this, or do they all have it?
This is supposed to be something that is available to any of the AI-assisted DVR boxes. So the most recent set of boxes that has been they've been out for quite some time. So if you haven't upgraded your Xfinity hardware in I think it's 4 years, then this may be something that you would need to change in order to gain access to. But there's also supposed to be a an Xfinity like web portal if you are a subscriber that gives you a lot of the same features.
You keep using the phrase supposed to and will and maybe. So is this remains to be seen once the Olympics start to see if it actually works.
If there's one thing I've learned about Olympics coverage is that nothing ever goes 100% to plan, so I tend to hedge quite a bit, yeah.
This is Tech Tuesday, where we are talking with Russell Hawley. We talked about Samsung earlier, but Samsung isn't the only tech company looking into upgrades. Apple recently announced the release of its second generation AirTag for those who want an easier way to keep track of devices. Now, I'm a big fan of the AirTag. I have three of them in action right now at all times. So what is this upgrade? Do I need the second generation AirTag?
So the second generation AirTag does three things to kind of change the way that AirTags work. The first is it has a 50% increase on its visible range. That doesn't just mean your ability to connect directly to an AirTag if you have lost something, but also the kind of larger AirTag network, where if you have lost something that has an AirTag on it and it reaches out to any local iPhone to establish that Bluetooth connection to give you that geographic location, that range is now increased. So if you have lost something and you've lost it, say, in an airport and you need to reach it, your chances of finding it are quite a bit higher now. The speaker built into the AirTag is also now quite a bit louder in that it can be heard in a lot of different places. This is super useful if you are ever using the kind of chirp function on the AirTag to locate something instead of just kind of using your phone to navigate around your house to see that you have buried it in your couch cushions.
Oh, mine's the coat
And
po mine's the coat pocket. Keys are al always in the coat pocket.
yep. And then the third one is that the chirp itself, that sound that the AirTag makes when you are looking for it or when the battery is low or something like that, that has changed from the previous version in order to be easier to hear for folks who can't hear the precise frequency range that the previous speakers were able to communicate at.
Oh, so like a different pitch for people who can't hear
That's
them.
right. It'll sound slightly different, and that sound is slightly lower, which can reach more people.
There is concern that AirTags can be placed on devices or vehicles without the owner's knowledge or consent. Does this model have a way to combat that?
It is the same features that any AirTag has, in that it, regardless if you have an Android phone or an iPhone, if you have an AirTag that is not registered to your phone, and it has been with you for more than a day, it will you'll get a notification that says that there is an AirTag following you, and you can choose to engage the services to help locate it or to report it and disable it. There are now that AirTags have been out for quite some time, there are easier mechanisms for reporting these sorts of things to local police if you feel as though someone is using an AirTag to stalk you. Apple's actually implemented quite a few features to make sure that it is not impossible but difficult to use these as kind of a stalking method. And then included in that is you know something that makes it so that it will report even if you have an Android phone, to kind of let that person know that these tools are in place. I put simply, if your goal is to stalk someone, there are not only easier to use but cheaper mechanisms to do that, unfortunately.
Got it. Did Apple increase the price of the AirTag at all?
Nope, it's the exact same price, and a lot of the same features exist. If you order directly from Apple, you have the ability to choose from a bunch of different things that you can have engraved on the AirTag itself, or you can go into any electronic store and pick them up in either as individuals or packs of two or packs of four.
All right. We have been talking about recent tech news with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks so much for your time, Russell. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I want to say thanks to our staff, producers Marcus Charleston and Aaron Esmont-Rabinowitz, student producers Iza Huck, Colin Simpson, and Brianna Fortunate. Our student producer from Denison University is Kiara Burson, and our high school student producer is Henry Allen. Video production by the Ohio Channel, board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
For the past month, Nick Benson has been driving to the Minneapolis airport and watching as planes chartered by the U.S. government are loaded up with detainees caught up in President Trump's immigration surge.
You could be sitting in the Delta lounge eating your cheese and cracker.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.